the wartime storm thing. October 15th, 1989, CAF Oral History Center. Interviewee is Clarence Mast. Interviewer Margaret Kaywood. It's 9:50 a.m.
Okay.
I'm Clarence Mast, and I was born in 1917, and we lived in Georgetown, Texas for a while. Moved out to Lubbock, Texas when my father was professor of physics at the new university there. And
what university is out of Lubbock?
Texas Tech.
Oh.
It's a university now, but it was Texas Tech College in those days. Texas Technological College. He was on the original staff, and I went through grade school there and high school and through college. And then I went to Johns Hopkins Medical School, and my two brothers also had gone to Johns Hopkins, and so we were the only three brothers that ever graduated from Johns Hopkins Medical School.
Three brothers, all doctors.
Right. I graduated from high school in 1932, I guess, and from 34, and from college in 1938, and from Johns Hopkins in 1942. And then I went to the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York, at Strong Memorial Hospital, and did my internship, which
Strong
was...
Strong or Strong?
Strong, S-T-R-O-N-G,
Strong
Memorial Hospital.
Okay.
And it was to be a two-year internship in obstetrics, gynecology, and surgery, but the war cut it down to 9 months, as it did all internships. And so I was free after 9 months, and I went to my hometown, which was by then Lubbock, Texas. And I worked with Dr. J.T. Krueger, K-R-E-U-G-E-R, and that was a job my brother had, and I did surgery for that 3 months. Then I went to the United States Navy, and I went back to Sampson Naval Training Center, which was
S-A-M-P-S-O-N,
which was a boot camp for the Navy. And they put me at Sampson Naval Hospital. And after a short time...
What was in there? Just
there were,
did you get men from overseas, or were they...
No, these
troops,
were boot trainees. Boots. They were 15,000 trainees at Sampson. And we had a big hospital. Somehow they remember 6,000 beds, but that may be wrong. That's too high, I think, but... they asked me what I knew about spinal meningitis, and I said very little. I was interested in surgery. And the captain said, good, you have until noon to brush up on spinal meningitis because you have ward C2. You've got 33 cases there, and there are three more coming in this morning. So I had 30 minutes to, about 3 hours to review on spinal meningitis, and I took the ward, and I was there for a month.
Okay, what were the most common problems those young troops had?
Well, this was before the days of penicillin. The sulfa drugs had just been invented a short time before, and the treatment for spinal meningitis, fortunately, is sulfa drugs, and still is. so-called cat fever, which was catarrhal fever, was a sore throat, was one of the main things. But if a man was not fit for duty, then he had to go to the hospital. There was no other place to put him. He couldn't stay home. He had to go into the hospital. And so a lot of people were in the hospital that might have been at home had it been in civilian life. And urinary infections, there were some venereal disease. We had an outbreak of spinal meningitis, and that will overtake a whole big area where people are sleeping together in
Did you
barracks.
Find what caused it?
Well, we know what causes spinal meningitis. It just got started, and it was hard to stop.
You know, that like our son had meningitis, and it was the same thing that causes flu.
There are two kinds of meningitis, really. One is a viral meningitis, and it's harder to treat than is the so-called spinal meningitis, which is due to the Streptococcus meningococcus.
Okay,
the bacteria.
The sulfa probably worked on
that. It works on that, but it doesn't work on the viral.
And was there
what
any
we had
treatment at all in your
on
time?
On the viral?
Yeah, in your time.
No, not for viral, but we didn't have much viral encephalitis at that time, or meningitis. That's encephalitis, really, brain infection. And spinal meningitis started out in the spinal cord, and then would get to the brain, and if untreated, they died from it. And the treatment was to do a spinal tap and take out a little fluid and inject some sulfonamides into the spinal canal, along with putting the person on the sulfonamide drug orally. And they got well rapidly and quickly, thank goodness. And it saved many, many young men's lives. They wouldn't have gotten it, perhaps, if they weren't in boot camp, but we were at war, and so they had to go. After I stayed there for a little while, the captain was making inspections one day, and on my ward, he couldn't find anything that wasn't clean, and he had some white gloves that he was keeping in his pockets and would put on one and inspect various places. And so I showed him how I could wipe on the top of the door, the top of the flat part of the door, and usually find dust, and he thought that was great. So I got to be his assistant for inspection of the entire hospital every Saturday morning.
Oh, and weren't you happy about that?
You bet. I carried the white gloves, and he did the rest of it. But we found dirt almost everywhere we looked, because it's just a matter of like looking on the top of a thermostat, for example. Dirt was.
How about keep. Under a cupboard?
Under a cupboard, there are lots of places. Pull out the drawer and on the top of the drawer.
Yeah.
And they had to do something to keep people on their toes. And cleanliness, of course, is a great part of health, and it was in those days. And then I went to Camp Perry, Virginia. Camp Perry, which was the just out of Williamsburg, Virginia, which was the makeup area for the Seabees. And the Seabees are the construction battalions, and they were operated by the Navy. And they had two medical officers, and I was the youngest, so I was a junior medical officer. And my commanding officer, my senior medical officer, was Favel, Barry, B-A-R-R-Y, from Chicago, and he had been out of medical school 7 years longer than I had, and we got along together very well, and we stayed in Virginia for a period of about a month while the battalion made up. Then we had a 10-day...
So you were going to be a part of this battalion, right?
Yes, I was part of it. I was their junior medical officer.
So... You really didn't have much duties that month, right?
Not a whole lot, except we had to run sick bay and have sick call. One of our company commanding officers decided that they would, I guess it was a commanding officer, decided they would take the entire battalion through an area in part of their maneuvers and whatnot. And so he had them go through this forested area, which they all did. And he didn't know that it was live with poison ivy.
Oh.
And so we ordered two barrels of calamine lotion to treat those men with, because everybody had the itch for a long time.
That's not
that.
Funny. I've had that pretty bad.
It's not funny. And we disabled the battalion for a little while. Mm-hmm. We were then sent to Quoddy, Q-U-O-D-D-Y, Village, Maine, which is in Eastport, Maine, the most eastern port in the United States, most eastern city in the United States. It's up on the Bay of Fundy, F-U-N-D-Y. And the Bay of Fundy has extremely high tides.
Yeah, and, something like what?
27 feet, I think it was there. And they decided to harness the tides, and the government had there, and they would run the water into one basin and out of that basin into another basin, which was kept empty through generators. And from that one, they dump it back into the sea. So they had a constant flow of water through there, they were going to have. And Eleanor Roosevelt was quite interested in this. And it never did work out completely. And they spent all the money on making this little village, Quoddy Village, which would house about 5,000 people. But they were built on temporary foundations. And our job was to take the village, lift it up, and put permanent foundations under there. Our commanding officer was not a concrete man, and he ordered concrete to be poured on a day that was freezing, and the concrete froze and was rotten concrete. Yeah. And the man that poured the concrete said, "Commander, I can't pour concrete today or tomorrow. The water is frozen, the gravel is frozen, and we just can't pour water. I can't pour concrete." And he said, "Well, melt it. Put a fire under it and melt it and pour that concrete today." So being a CPO, a chief petty officer, he did what he was told to do, but he also had witnesses to what he'd been told to do. And after they took the forearms off, he came in with a sledgehammer and with about a dozen of the officers as witness, and hit that pier with a sledgehammer, and it just pulverized. And the next day we had a new commanding officer.
You needed one.
We needed one because he was not the right kind of a person. And the new commanding officer that we got, D.Y. Taylor from Bedford, D.Y. Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, from Bedford, B-E-D-F-O-R-D, Massachusetts, was a good commanding officer, and we kept him for the rest of the time I was with the battalion. We stayed in Eastport for about 3 months, and then took the train the long way around on government grant mileage because it was free transportation. And I think we went about 6,000 miles to get to Hueneme, H-U-E-N-E-M-E. I believe that's the way you spell it. H-U-E-N-E-M-E, Hueneme, California, which was a jumping-off place for the Marines and for the CBs. We waited there for transportation for a while and then went to Oahu in Hawaii and stayed there for about 9 months, during which time we built the Marine barracks on Mauna Loa Ridge.
M-A-U-N-A?
M-O-N-A-L-A-U-A, Mauna Loa Ridge. And built the Marine barracks, and then I was detached from the 112th, and Dr. Barry and I both went to the Naval Air Station Kaneohe, K-A-N-E-O-H-E, which was on the windward side of the island, and is still a naval station, has been for years, and was there in peacetime.
Were you treating local people with this island?
No, we were treating troops that were stationed there.
Yeah.
And there were about 15,000 people on Kaneohe Naval Air Station. And when the carriers would come in, the pilots for the planes would then transfer to the barracks that we had at Kaneohe. And we sometimes would have an influx of some 5,000, we call them zoomies, because they were the boys flying the planes. They were young men, some of them quite arrogant and quite proud and a little hard to get along with, and they were drinking heavily because they were going back on the carriers. They were going back into battle and they didn't know whether they were going to get back or not, and some of them didn't.
So what sort of stuff did you treat?
When I was there, Dr. Barry and I were put in charge of the surgical ward. And we did all the surgery on that station. We had 7 deaths from men falling off of motor scooters, and they then banned motor scooters. And we had one man that was run over by the nose wheel of an airplane, and then he was crushed, and we had to take care of him. Our CBs were working on, that was on Tinian. But we took care of all kinds of things and did operations, such things as appendicitis and hernias, and a lot of athlete's foot, and a lot of infections. And while we were on Kaneohe Naval Air Station, penicillin became available. And we got some of the first penicillin that was there. And we had a young man who had gotten a coral infection in his shin on his right leg, and it was quite red and inflamed, and we'd been unable to control it for a period of about 6 weeks using sulfonamide drugs, hot magnesium sulfate, Epsom salts, compresses. And even it was such a bad wound that we, at one time, to clean it up, got some maggots, and those are fly larvae, and put the maggots on it, and it cleaned it up, but he still was running an infection. And then when we got the penicillin, we were giving minute doses in those days, 10,000 units every 8 hours, or every 3 hours, that's 8 doses a day. And now they give maybe 5 or 10 million units at a time, once or twice a day. But we started off in small, multiple doses. And the next day he was looking better and feeling better and his temperature was down. And 2 days later he was markedly on the road to recovery. We'd found the drug that would cure his infection. If we hadn't had that, we were getting ready to amputate his leg. We had done about 6 amputations in the previous 3 or 4 months because of injuries and things of that nature and lack of an adequate antibiotic. So when penicillin came out, it was truly a miracle drug, and we were very happy to get it. After we were on Oahu, we also rebuilt the runway on Kaneohe Naval Air Station that was hit by the Japs first when the Pearl Harbor occurred. They came around on the windward side of the island, came around Diamond Head and came in from that direction to hit Pearl Harbor. And there's a picture show called Tora Tora Tora. And in that picture show is a young lady flying a small airplane, and she is a pilot instructor. And she was the first one to see him, and she got out of the way. And her name was Cornelia Fort, C-O-R-N-E-L-I-A-F-O-R-T. And she was one of the first women to join up after that as a WASP. Cornelia Fort was killed in San Angelo, Texas, when one of the flyboys came in and zoomed her airplane and crashed the canopy on her trainer, and she fell to her death. Her brother, Dudley Fort, in Nashville, Tennessee, D-U-D-L-E-Y-F-O-R-T, and he and I went turkey hunting up in New Mexico, and that's how I got to be familiar with Cornelia. And she was the first female killed in armed services in the United States during World War II. There were other women who died in the WASP and whatnot, in plane crashes and whatnot, but she was the first woman to be killed in the forces. The WASP were really not part of the forces at that time. It was later that they got their proper recognition. After we were in Kaneohe, we got orders to go west, and we went to the Marshall Islands and went to Tinian. And when we got to Tinian, it was not completely restored or taken over. And so we had to camp down on one end in pup tents, and we're on K-rations for a long period of time, about 3 weeks, and you get a little tired of canned ham and cheese and things of that nature, two cigarettes, a fig bar, and lemon juice. I made up some lemon juice one day in my canteen and set it there. We were out in the sunlight, and I had to go do something. And I came back about an hour later to have my lemonade that was made out of a powder with rich in citric acid and other things, and those canteen cups were aluminum, and this had dissolved a hole in the bottom of my canteen cup. And that's why we were putting it in our stomachs. But it was pretty good. It was pretty good. We went on K-rations after that, and we had dehydrated food for a period of 3 months. But we built our CB camp at that time. The commanding officer got his orders, and he opened them up and said, "You're to find 4 million cubic yards of coral. You're to blast it loose, dig it up, haul it over, and dump it along a certain pathway over here so that when you finish, you'll have two runways that are 500 feet wide, paved, and 9,534 feet long," or that's about 9,500 feet long. And I said, "Man, we don't have any airplanes that require runways like that." And they said, "We do now." And that was the B-29. And the B-29s were in India at that time. And then they came to Westfield from India to begin with. And so we had 186 hard stands, because each plane has to have its own parking area, and that's called a hard stand. And then they had the two runways on Westfield, which was on the west side of the island and about toward the upper half of the island. And Northfield, which was the field from which the atomic bomb took off from, was the largest airport in the world at that time. And when they were functioning at full blast, there were some 45 planes, two B-29s taking off from Northfield every 45 seconds. And so it was a very busy airport.
What were your duties? Now, what kind of stuff were you treating at this stage?
I was still the 112th CB medical officer, junior medical officer. And at that time, the humidity was about 85%, and the temperature was about 85% day and night, and fungus was rampart everywhere. We spent a lot of time treating fungus in ears, and I'm a pretty good expert on pouring iodine in a guy's ear, rolling them over and pouring it in the other ear, turning him back and filling it with boric acid ointment, turning him back on the other side and filling that ear with boric acid ointment, and then putting some cotton in there. And we gave him a quarter grain of morphine before we did that, because 3.5% iodine in an inflamed ear is one of the most painful things that you can have. So we treated their pain before we treated their fungus infections. and we found out it was about the only thing that would cure it. It cured it, and the boric acid prevented it from coming back because it had the boric acid. Fungus doesn't like boric acid, so it worked. And athlete's foot was another thing. The coral is very hard on shoes, and so they wore out the shoes, and they ordered a new set of shoes for them. And for the whole battalion, I think we had some 1,500 pair of shoes come in. There were 1,200 men in the battalion. And somebody forgot that we were in the South Pacific, and they sent us shoes that were made for Iceland and Newfoundland, where we thought we were going. As a matter of fact, when we were in Eastport, we were all issued winter gear. And the winter gear in that time consisted of multi-layered clothing. The inside was kind of soft and cotton material, as I recall. And then there were about seven or eight layers of paper. And then the outer was a hard green cloth, and it rustled when you walked, but the layers of air created by the paper kept you warm. Nowadays, they make layers of air with using Dacron or something else, and multi-layers that way, but not with paper. But ours were made with paper at that time. And then we had to turn those in, give it back when we decided. They knew where we were going, but we didn't. And in the South Pacific, you don't need cold clothing. On Tinian, it was so hot and so humid that one day I was doing health records, and I was sitting in a Quonset hut. I had a fan going on me, and all I had on was a pair of shoes and socks and a pair of officer's shorts, no shirt or t-shirt or anything else, and had a glass of salt water or a pitcher of salt water over there, and about a half dozen towels. I put one arm on one towel, one arm on the other towel, mopped my face and chin and nose and chest so that I could lean over and write typhus injection or whatever it was on that piece of paper. And I had 1,200 health things I had to write out in longhand and put on their records and whatnot. And it was so hot and humid that you would drip on them. In those days, we used ink, and we didn't have ballpoint pens. And so you had to blot it and keep it from smearing and that kind of thing. But the heat was tremendous. And we treated other things that would come up, injuries of all kinds, and it was a great challenge to prevent fungus infections in wounds because they were very, very common. And what else? We'd have the usual things, psychological ones. We had one chief that thought his shoulder would go out of place every now and then. And I would, he was a yeoman in the personnel office, and his shoulder being out of place wouldn't really hurt anything very mad. A bad shoulder wouldn't hurt, but he was an excellent yeoman. And so Dr. Bear and I were going somewhere one day, and I stopped by his tent, and I manipulated his shoulder a little bit, just kind of wiggled around and said, "Now this is going to hurt for a minute, hold still." And I pulled and jerked and did something to it and threw it back up on his chest, and I said, "Oh, okay, that fix it, Chief, you feel like?" "Oh, yes, that's much better." There wasn't anything matter with that guy's shoulder except that he needed a little sympathy, and he got a little sympathy. And when we walked out, Dr. Bear said, "You ought to feel ashamed of yourself for doing something like that." I said, "He'll be back to work this afternoon, and isn't that what we're here for?" And he said, "Well, yes." And I said, "Okay, let's go on and do what we were doing." Also, when we were on Tinian, we ran out of alcohol, and we used it to make various solutions with and whatnot. And it was grain alcohol, drinking alcohol, but it was 190 proof. It was pretty strong. It's like Everclear, E-V-E-R-C-L-E-R, which you can buy now at the liquor stores, and if you dilute it with water, it will still burn. And if you take a pint of Everclear and mix it with water, you got 2 pints of vodka. It's essentially the same thing. It just has no flavor, and it's a whole lot cheaper than vodka. And I take it on my hunting trips undiluted, because you can use it to start fires in rainstorms or snowstorms, and you can mix it with a little water and turn it with your finger, and you got a pretty good drink. If you put a little Coke or something in it, why, that's even better. But we ordered 4 cans of alcohol, which was 20 gallons. That would be 40 gallons of whiskey. And when we got it, we got only one. But we knew that 4 of them had been shipped out from where it came from. But when it got to us, we only had one. So 3 of them had been stolen. And we figured that stevedores did it when they were unloading the ship, and that they probably sold it to somebody. And so I got in the Jeep and changed my officer's clothes to what couldn't recognize as enlisted. And I just drove around the island, and I found a little shack where they were selling Coca-Colas for $3 a piece. And I figured they were putting something in it, and because Cokes were either free or a nickel. And so I stopped there and ordered one of them, and they had my three cans of alcohol in underneath there. And they poured me a Coke, opened a Coke and poured out some and poured in an ounce of Everclear, which would be 2 ounces of whiskey. And I gave them $3 and drank it. And before it hit me too hard, I went down and got the shore patrol. We came back there and arrested all of them and got our alcohol back. And I don't know what happened to them, but they apparently were arrested and, for stealing. And I proved that it had it written on there what it was. And the shore patrol. And to get cooperation of the shore patrol, I even gave them a little bit. So, you know, you got to buy your way through.
The military way.
Yeah, you got to buy your way through. And on Tinian, we finished the airstrip, West Field, and worked on North Field for a little while. And then we got orders to go to Okinawa. And we went to Okinawa and got there just as the typhoon was coming in. And there were a convoy of 17 LSTs that came into Naha Bay, and we were
N-A-H-A.
And that's on the east side of the island at the lower portion. And the town of Naha had been very well destroyed by artillery and that type of thing. And it was just a shambles. And we were told that we were at the wrong place, that our convoy was to go around to Buckner Bay, and Buckner Bay was much larger and was around on the east side of the island. And so by the time we came around there, a hurricane was coming in, or what did they call them in the Pacific?
Typhoon.
Typhoon was coming in. And as we headed in toward the bay, it was right at dark, and the light started flashing, saying that we were headed for a mine torpedo net. A mine submarine net, and it would not open until tomorrow morning, and for us to go back out to sea and come in tomorrow morning. And somebody signaled back that there's a typhoon out there, and they said, sorry, we don't open that net until tomorrow morning. There must have been 150 battleships and cruisers and destroyers and LSTs and whatnot in Naha at that time, in Buckner Bay at that time. And we could see why they didn't want a submarine to slip in there, because it could have sunk many ships. So we started back out, and we were number three in the convoy, and the first one turned to the right, but LST draws only 3 feet of water in the bow and 14 feet in the stern. And the wind was coming at right angles to it when it was turned to go back out, and kept blowing it up toward the coral reef, which made the bay. And the first ship was picked up by a wave and set down on top of a big old coral spike, and was still there 20 years later, I know of, and whether it's still there or not, I don't know. And the second ship turned to the opposite direction, and the wind got it and did the same thing. So I told the captain on our ship, and he and I had gotten to be good friends, and I was up on topside with him, and I said, why don't we just back out? And he said, well, we're going to have to. And I said, the wind's going to blow you up on there too, so why don't we just back out? And he said, well, I can't back out without signal. And I said, well, just radio them. He said, we're in radio silence. I said, well, just use a blinker, and all the ships will see that we're headed for a mine submarine net. And he said, well, we're in darkness. I can't do that either. Blackout. And he said, I can blow the horn up here, and two blasts on the horn means we're backing up. And nowadays, all big machinery and whatnot, they go beep, 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 beep when they back up. And so he hit the horn a couple of times, and some seagull had built a nest up there, and all it did was psh, psh, psh. So he broke out a light and signaled that all of the ships then saw it, said, back out, don't try to turn, because the wind will blow you. You can't turn in this wind. And it picked up, and it was real strong. So we went backed up and went out to sea and spent the night at sea in the typhoon that came in through that area.
Tell me about your night at sea in the typhoon.
The LST that we were in had pontoons tied onto the side, and pontoons are great big steel things about the size of this room almost. They're, I think, 8 by 8 by 8 feet or something of that nature, 10 by 10 by 10, and they have places on the side where they can be riveted or bolted together, and they're pretty strong bolting areas. and you can float them out on the ocean or a river or something, and then it makes a floating dock. And it goes up and down, and ships can come in there and load and unload on a floating pontoon, because a pontoon of that size displaces a lot of water. And so we had pontoons on there, and that made the ship heavier, but it also prevented some of the roll, because when it would roll, or the waves would come in, the pontoons would sink on that.
Then it has to wind.
Okay.
All right.
It was a little windy and a little wet and a little hairy, but it wasn't too bad. And the next morning we came in there, but we still had wind. And the captain came in through the net and was to turn to the right, which he did, and go down between in front of a row of ships to our berth. And the wind kept blowing us toward one ship I thought we were going to be pretty close to. And I said, "Captain," said, "if you don't pick up some speed, you're not going to clear his anchor chain." "Oh, we'll clear it. add five." Top speed, add five more. And he had that thing full blast. And I went back to the stern, and just as we passed that ship, I thought the wind was strong enough that I bet I could, what's a good word besides spit? I could spit over on their deck, and I did. That's how close we were. And the prop just missed the anchor chain because I was watching it. But we got in our berth, and then we anchored and stayed there. Then we unloaded and went on into Okinawa and did what we were supposed to do there. We had one of those pontoons on Tinian, and we had had no fresh meat for a period of about 3 months, and this was to be the first fresh meat we got. And we had 1,200 ribeyes, bacon wrapped, good meat, and we were going to have it on Sunday. And we got this on about Monday, and we're going to have it the following Sunday for a good meal. So we had made one of these pontoons into a little reefer, an ice box. It was insulated a little bit on the inside. We had a compression unit out there and a gasoline engine running it and that type of thing. And it was about all it could do to keep it good and cold and that type of thing and frozen. And so they got the meat, which was frozen, and put it in there, and it was keeping it just fine. And then we had a CPO, a chief petty officer, who somehow or other got some beer, because he figured that cold beer would go very well with that meat on Sunday. And so without permission, he put that meat, that beer in on top of that meat. And the beer had been sitting under a tarp and was about 130 degrees, and it was hot beer. I mean, really hot beer. And all it did was overload and stop the circulation in that reefer that we had. And I came by there on a Friday, and it had a bad odor to it. So I got the chief to open it up, and sure enough, all the meat had spoiled. And so we didn't have fresh meat on Sunday, because some chief petty officer was trying to do what he thought was a good thing.
Did they know who he was?
We found out who he was.
Did he live through
that? Yeah, they do all kinds of things. He survived.
What did they do to him? I know they did something.
They did something to him, but he remained a chief petty officer and whatnot, and it was ignorance. And
it wasn't.
You can't really blame people for ignorance. You can, but you can't do much about it. It was sad that we lost all that meat, but so be it. I was a little lucky because I had made some friends with some of the Marines on Tinian, and they didn't have a doctor, so I would go over there and take care of some of their problems sometimes. And every now and then, those Marines had steaks, and they came in about three times a week, and they had a few extra, and they would barbecue them, and they would invite some of their friends over sometimes. And so I'd had a few barbecued steaks barbecued over a foxhole and that type of thing, and it wasn't bad. The day the war was over, we were on Okinawa, and we had built a foxhole, my senior medical officer and I, on our little cliff there. The dirt was real soft at that one particular place. And I had brought a jackhammer up there shortly before and drilled a hole down beneath our tent and stuck a stick of dynamite down in it. And I blasted a hole, or half a stick of dynamite, and I blasted a hole in the coral that was right under our tent. And then I put a pipe in it, and the wastewater from our wash basin, which was handmade, and we had water, running water up there, would go down in that, and it drained. And we had a dry tent around there, and all the rest of the officers had wet spots under their tents. But ours was dry because I got rid of the water. But I also dug a foxhole with that jackhammer. It didn't take very long to do it. So when the war was over and everybody started shooting the guns off, the bullets started falling in various places, and I think there were some 11 people killed that night just from falling bullets and shrapnel and that type of stuff. And we went out there and got in there in our foxhole until everybody ran out of ammunition. I saw one of the CBs with a submachine gun, a Thompson submachine gun, and I think we had three of them, and he'd gotten one somehow or other. And the barrel was red hot. And he'd put in a clip and throw one into the chamber. It was so hot the thing would cook off or fire by itself, and it would go ahead and empty the clip. And that's what made the barrel get red hot. And so he got rid of all the 45 ammunition that we had in this Thompson submachine. They fired 45 machine gun bullets, 45 caliber shell ammunition. But he used up all the ammunition we had. We didn't need it anymore, so and he was celebrating. Then came back, and the physicians were not as lucky as some of the other people. They had a lot of people in the services that had to be discharged. And those that had to be discharged had to have physical examinations, and only the physicians could do it. And so we had to spend at least 9 months extra in the service. And I didn't get out until the war was over in, what was it, August? And I didn't get out until the next April. And
but you were good at physicals by then.
I was good. I was put in charge. We went to...
Where were you?
I'm trying to think of the name of it. The lake just north of New Orleans. I'm trying to say Passamaquoddy, but that's not it.
Pontchartrain.
Pontchartrain. Lake Pontchartrain Naval Air Center. Lake Pontchartrain Naval Air Center. And that was converted into a separation center. And we would separate about 600 men a day, or 670 or whatever it might be. And they would come in a big group, and we'd divide them up into about 30. And they'd run them through, and we'd do their physical examinations with the men stark naked during 30 at a time. And you got pretty good at that. And after about a month, I was detached from the enlisted personnel separation and was put in with the officer personnel. I was in charge of the officer personnel separation. And there I examined one officer at a time. And I liked to have a person lay down on a table, and I'd have them look at my finger, look at that cotton which I had glued to the ceiling. Now look at my finger, and that made their eyes move back and forth, and it gave them something to concentrate on. And I had a major, well, he wasn't a major, lieutenant commander, came in there one time, and he asked, what is that cotton for on the ceiling? And I looked up the ceiling, and I said, what cotton? And he said, that cotton right up there. And I said, cotton up there? I don't he said, no, there's nothing up there. And I said, well, I don't see any cotton up there. And he said, no, I guess I had something in my eye, and he rubbed his eye a little bit. And I knew the cotton was up there. And so
yeah,
I went ahead and examined him and had him look at various things and whatnot, but I didn't talk about the cotton and didn't use it anymore. And then I wrote on his report that this man can be talked out of something that is actually there. There was some cotton up there, and I asked him, I said, what cotton? And if this man is ever in charge of a destroyer or a cruiser or something, and somebody says there's a periscope out there and he doesn't feel like seeing a periscope, he might not see it. Or if he saw it, he might deny it. And so I personally don't think he should ever be in command for anything. And I got a letter back from somewhere in the Navy once upon a time, three or six months later. That man had been taken out of the Navy, he'd lost his commission, and they said, we'll never take him again. And we wish more medical officers would find such things like this, because how can you prove that a man can be talked out of something?
Yeah.
So felt I did my duty.
Did your duty to help somebody.
Yeah. We also had a four-striper, a captain, come through there for separation, and he'd been in the reserves, and he had a bilateral hernia. He was Hebrew, and it's a little hard for a Gentile to tell a Hebrew that something's wrong with him when he doesn't believe it or doesn't want to believe it. And I wouldn't let him out without signing a release for his two bilateral inguinal hernias, which is a kind of inguinal,
I can spell G-U-A-L, that.
Okay, I-N-G-U-A-L, hernia, inguinal hernia. And he wouldn't sign the release, so we sent him over to the hospital at Grenada, New Orleans, G-R-E-N-A-D-A, and they had a hospital there, a naval hospital. And I called over there and talked to the officer of the day, who happened to be a friend of mine, John Gerald Thompson, who died a number of years ago. John Gerald Thompson. He and I were Boy Scouts together many years ago. And I told him, I said, John Gerald, you've got a real mad horse driver coming over, and he's got a bilateral hernia, but he doesn't believe it. So don't you greet him at the door. You get somebody down there that's got 2.5 or 3 stripes on him, or 4 if you can find somebody, and let them bring him in, because he's mad. And so they did. And they brought him in there, and he believed them, I guess, for a while. But I saw him again about 5 or 6 weeks later, because he'd been in the hospital, and he came back and said, Doctor, I'm sorry, I got so mad. I said, I didn't really think I had a hernia, let alone 2. And I got him fixed over there, and I don't have them now. And he had 2 nice little scars there, and he didn't have any hernia, so I let him get separated then. But he got his hernia fixed in the Navy before he got out. A lot of them would just sign a release, you know, thinking that they didn't really have it, but he wouldn't sign a release. So lots of things happened while we were in the service. And if you talk long enough, you'll recall things from time to time. But then, you know, I got interested in the B-29s because they were taken off of Tinian.
Well, I stopped this at the end of your...
Okay.